Club. Driving. No purchase necessary.
You're listening to Radio Free Urbanism.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Urbanism podcast about urbanism and stuff. I am your host today, Nick Laporte, and I am joined by one of my co-hosts here. You know him, you love him, Ethan Myers.
Welcome back, everybody.
And we have a very special guest filling in for our own Alex today. We have from Bike Talk, Taylor.
Hey, you guys. Everything totally froze on me just then. I don't know what happened. Are we all okay? Are we going?
It's still recording. We're still live. We're still going. Yeah.
Okay, good. Sorry about that. I have no idea what happened. Right when Ethan started to talk, maybe that's a message. Like, don't listen to Ethan. Is that it?
Many people are saying this, folks. Right, yeah.
Which is complete nonsense. This guy's right. Our in-house transit expert. We got to listen to him.
Great.
He's got some knowledge. Yeah. So, Taylor Nichols, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. I'm very excited to have you here. So, can you tell us and tell the people, who is Taylor Nichols?
Well, thanks, Nick. Thanks, Ethan. I come to Radio Free Urbanism by way of the bicycle. I've been a bicycle advocate for a long time. I was one of those kids who delivered newspapers on a bike when I was a kid. And I lived in New York City for a long time, and I really got into bicycle advocacy then, and then moved out to Los Angeles in the 90s, and I've been living here since then. And I'm a bike rider. I'm a guy who believes that there are solutions to problems that society is dealing with. And while the bicycle may not answer any one of those problems, it is a part of a solution to many of the problems. By trade, I'm an actor, but by passion, I'm a cyclist.
Wonderful.
I love that. And I always try to come up with that because I know I heard you talk about that before on the show, which is it's not the solution, but it's a part of many solutions.
Right, right. And I really believe that. I mean, it's a part of the solution to, you know, climate change. It's a part of the solution to, you know, no parking, to congestion, to obesity with our children, to mental health. It's really a wonderful human invention.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
Efficient ways to get around it still, right. Which is unbelievable. And it just keeps getting better. And we're going to talk about a few things today.
Right.
And we've talked about it many times. It's the e-bike, but we'll get to that.
Totally.
So yeah, thank you so much for the introduction. We're so happy to have you here again. Ethan, do you have any updates?
None currently. It's actually been a pretty uneventful time for me. But Nick, it seems like you have some updates. So please fill us in.
Indeed. So before we get to that, we just have to shout out the Patreon. So we got a new patron. I think it was Dean who joined. Thank you so much for joining us. The live show is on now. It looks like we have somebody commenting in the live comments right now. And what's available? Yeah, we got the live show. We got early access to the shows if you want to join us on Patreon. And I forgot to add it, which is access to the Discord last week. I guarantee after the show it will be there. You can get into the Discords where we can share as much information with you as possible, including who we're going to have on the show, like Taylor Nichols here today. So that's really cool. Yeah, I have one update, and it's going to be more of an update next week, but I need to talk about it right now, and that is the Beach Avenue bike lane here in Vancouver. So if you don't know Vancouver, this has been turned into probably one of the best cycling places in the city. So this used to be a 3/4-lane street. Now has been turned into a street that's two or one way with a lovely wide separated cycling track as well. And it has become probably the most used cycle lane in the city. One, beautiful views. It is absolutely lovely. As you can see here, if you're watching on YouTube, I have some B-roll from a drone shot that I took. And it's just, it's lovely. It's flat. And I just absolutely love riding here. It's not a thoroughfare for myself, but it is used by many people in the city. Now, there's something that's happening right now in the city that is potentially rather unfortunate, is that they're going to turn back part of this into two-way traffic. So I'm going to share here on my screen what the actual cycle lane looks like now. So this is closer to Stanley Park. So here you can see there's a two-way cycle lane here, and there's also a one-way lane for car traffic here. So now what they're proposing is to turn this back into two-way traffic for cars and kind of making space or moving over the cycle lane. So it's not adding or removing these cycling lanes, but actually adding to traffic. And the problem that I have with this is that this is encouraging people to rat run through the park, where people are coming from the North Shore, being able to get off the bridge and go through the park to cut in to the city, which is obviously going to induce more demand and is going to have more traffic through the city. And this is not to mention that this is definitely probably one of the most pedestrian friendly places in the city right now. It's right beside probably the busiest beach in the whole city. We don't need more car traffic there. So Vancouver City Council right now is talking about it. People are calling in to talk about it and they're voting on whether or not that's going to happen. Again, my pessimism is going to come through. I'm going to say, yeah, they're probably going to end up having that go through, which is pretty disappointing.
God, it's so dispiriting, you guys, to make, you know, two steps forward and put this bike lane in, or maybe it's one step forward and putting the bike lane in and then go two steps back and take it out. It just is, you know, there is a learning curve to progress, and we have to give some of these things time.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I mean, bike networks aren't exactly something that one piece of it is going to, you know, make the entire network. It's a multitude of different, you know, pieces that need to be added to a bike grid to actually make it effective and have high ridership. And if you start taking out key pieces like this, not only are you not going to see that ridership ever form, but you're just never going to have, you're just never going to have that ridership.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, the key word there that I heard Nathan say is network. You know, we need a network in all cities.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's not like we're looking at those highway bike stripes that you see, you know, a lot of memes come through, like an actual highway, and they put a cycle lane there. It's like, why is there's never any cyclists biking in the bike lane? Like, why do we have, it's like, it's absolutely terrible. Yeah. Now, like I said, we're not getting rid of any of the cycling lanes. It'll still be there, but we're introducing more traffic to a now traffic calmed area. This is, you know, like many cities had, during COVID, we added more bike infrastructure. It's just too bad that the pendulum is swinging in the other direction, like we saw with the bike lane in Stanley Park.
Oh, God, and now that's heartbreaking.
Creeping out of the park into the West End here in Vancouver, which is really disappointing. But yeah, we'll update whether or not that happens next week on the show. I think it will. But again, I was surprised with that last update about the 30-kilometer streets here in Vancouver. So we'll see. So we're going to move on to our first story here, and this is coming from LA. And the reason why I put this in here is because I heard it on Bike Talk in the first place, and there was some really interesting stuff around that. So this is coming from the firefighters opposing safe streets in LA, which is pretty crazy. So can you tell us, Taylor, first of all, what is the Safe Streets Plan, HLA?
Right. Well, HLA is Healthy Streets Los Angeles, and it was supported by and promoted by an advocacy group called Streets for All. And it was really just a way to push the city to implement the city's own mobility plan, so that when you repave a street, you don't just repave it, you repave it and add what is ever designed for that street in the mobility plan. If it needs a bike lane, if it needs a pedestrian upgrade, if it needs automobile traffic upgrades, you would do that and implement those changes when you repave the street. And it really makes common sense. And it was just on the ballot last month in Los Angeles and won overwhelmingly with like 65% of the support of the voters. But you're right, the firefighters union, not the fire department, it's important to realize that it's a firefighters union, came out against it. And we actually played on Bike Talk, which can be found at biketalk.org, by the way.
Yes, plug it in, plug it in.
Absolutely. We played a clip of the president of the firefighters union just railing on this idea that you'll never ride a bike in Los Angeles. It's not real. It's not, you know, it's not good. We're against it. And it's never going to work. Los Angeles is a car city. It's not a bike city. And it was really, you know, 20th century thinking and talking. And it's funny, I have reached out to a few firefighters, you know, in a completely non-scientific poll. And the firefighters that I have spoken with are totally for it. And we're not even sure why the union was against it. The union felt like maybe HLA was going to take away money from supporting fire departments. And that's not even the case necessarily. And, you know, of course, fire departments always put up an argument about, will it be safe for us to get to fires if we put in a bike lane on this street or something like that? And 9 times out of 10, it's much easier for fire departments to get to traffic crashes, which is their main source of being called out on duty, and fires, which is only 5 or 10% of their calls, when there is bicycle infrastructure and traffic calming infrastructure on those streets. Like, for instance, taking a 4-lane road down to 3 lanes and having a center turn lane. That opens up a lane for a fire engine right there. When there's a bike lane on either side of the streets, you know, going in each direction, that gives cars room to go into if they need to clear space for a fire truck to go down the street. So those arguments really don't hold much water. And we were disappointed that the president of the firefighters union came out against it, but he was so kind of, I'm trying to think what the word is, just kind of crazy in the way he was talking that we really didn't take it seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. And the things that like you said, if you're adding safe infrastructure, you're adding bus lanes, you're adding bike lanes, it adds more flexible room for emergency services to use this. I saw this actually on the Beach Avenue bike lane just a few weeks ago. I was riding my bike down the Beach Avenue bike lane, and there was a fire truck and an ambulance in the bike lane, and we still had room to go around them. Right. So it adds that space for them. It actually reduces response times in what they found. Mm-hmm. But what I find most interesting and most compelling about this is that this can help reduce the amount of calls that they need to be called out in the first place.
Exactly. So, because most of their calls are car crashes, right?
Yeah. So yeah. I think that cost-benefit analysis needs to be done, and the evidence needs to be shown how this can actually make it safer. So I'm wondering if it's coming from that point. Is like the firefighter union worried about money being taken away because there's reduced calls? Is that it? Are they just fighting for their own?
The firefighter union is worried about anything that might take away support for the firefighters. And I think you guys, and certainly we at Bike Talk and, you know, certainly cycling advocates all agree that we support the fire department and we support firefighters. I mean, they're a huge asset to our community, but that doesn't mean they should stand in the way of progress. And sometimes they do.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Yeah, now, it's also good to mention, too, that there are once again, this is just the Firefighters Union of LA that's saying this. This isn't individual firefighters. There are actually a lot of firefighters who are very supportive of, you know, the urbanist movement of bike grids. And actually, there is a really there is a firefighter who is actually fairly famous or kind of growing on Instagram, who is actually a firefighting cyclist who commutes to his job at the fire department by cycling.
Right. I've heard of him. I'm trying to think where I heard of him or how I know of him, but I also have heard of him. So I'm really glad that there is at least one out there.
Is it Jeff Owen?
I think so.
There's someone called the cycling firefighter on Instagram.
Yes, that is him.
That's cool.
You gotta love social media.
Absolutely. It's incredible. So yeah, that's what we've seen here in Vancouver, at least with our city council. There's one particular councillor who's used to be a police officer, and it seems like all of his measures that he's trying to push through is to help the police department. And one of those was preventing red light and speed cameras from expanding the program in the city. Right. So, you know, he didn't say it outright, but a lot of people are wondering, hey, is that just because you're trying to prevent the VPD from having, you know, less calls to go to, less work to do?
Any cuts to their program? Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is,
well, you know, that's what's great, you guys, about a show like yours and a show like Bike Talk, is it really does give our listeners ammunition to then speak up at community meetings, at civic meetings, at governmental meetings, and explain to other people at the meeting, but also to the city council members and their staff, that sometimes they are still thinking in the 21st century. Not in the 20th century, excuse me, not in the 21st century. You know, it's like, I tried to lose weight in the 90s, and everyone said, all the books said, you know, don't eat fat. Fat makes you fat. Eat carbohydrates. That gives you energy. And that's what everyone said to do. So I did that. And did I lose any weight? No, I didn't lose any weight. And now we have shifted on how we think about that kind of stuff, because we were wrong in the 90s about food to eat to lose weight or to be healthy. And we were wrong in the last century about how to build our roads that were safer for everybody.
Yeah. And much like a lot of those, you know, things that were wrong in the past still stick around about carbs and fat. There's a lot of people who still think that building more roads and building more highways is going to help make us move around faster,
right,
which is not the case. Like the amount of times I hear people say, I have comments on my YouTube channel or my Instagram, and someone's like, you know, if you just make the streets slower, if you have more bike lanes, it's going to make the cars drive slower and there's going to be more emissions. It's like, no, it's emphatically wrong. Like the cities in the world that have the most congestion have the least amount of emissions per capita.
Yeah. It's like, you know, I got to, sorry to jump in, but we have a program in Los Angeles where we're trying to lower the speed of car traffic around schools, especially elementary schools where children, you know, get let out of the car and walk half a block into the school or whatever. And some radio host in Los Angeles went off on this about, oh my God, are you kidding that this organization wants to lower the speed of cars around schools? How many kids are going to be late to school now? I mean,
oh God. Wow. But yeah, that's very far removed. Oh
yeah.
As much as we like to think that the urbanist movement, you know, the making our cities better and less car dependent has really kind of broken the mainstream, in a lot of cases, it really hasn't. And that's why advocacy is so important on this case, because a lot of people hear these ideas and on the surface, they won't think about it too deeply and they'll think, this is crazy. I can't imagine driving slower. I can't imagine not driving at all or driving less. And then you have to, once you explain these ideas, once they start getting a little bit more popular, start being a little more understood, then you start getting, you know, more of the mainstream idea that, hey, maybe we don't have to rely on our cars for every single trip.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that's the key there, Nathan, every single trip.
Absolutely.
it's interesting to see what's going to happen. I think we need to go from the bottom up and get those, you know, the low down, motivations for people to get to switch or be at least interested in the type of things we talk about, the benefits that we can all have just as an individual. And that's kind of where I come from, is saying, hey, you can switch to micromobility right now. And there's, you know, a handful of reasons that that's going to help you immediately. Right. So you don't even have to talk about the bigger stuff. Like a lot of people don't want to talk about climate change or emissions or worry about their neighbor. And there's actual selfish reasons why these things are going to help you.
That and 45,000 Americans are killed every year on our streets because cars are going too fast or the driver is distracted.
Yeah.
It really worries me, Nick, about what's going on in Vancouver, because I've been to Vancouver many times and I think it's an amazing city. And it seems so kind of modern to me with high-rise buildings for housing and things like that. And Stanley Park is just a gem, and to have that overrun by cars again is a huge mistake and a step backwards.
Yeah, I think it's just, you know, the pendulum swings, right? It moves back a bit, and I think it's going to swing hard forward in the near future. Like, for example, this recent council, ABC, they're pretty conservative, and they've been the reason for a lot of this backlash, but that backlash has resurged critical mass. Critical mass disappeared, didn't exist in Vancouver. But, you know, a year and a half ago when the Stanley Park bike lane was happening, the Broadway bike lane that got canceled, it's back every last Friday of the month. Critical mass is happening in Vancouver. So I think people are, you know, showing up for it, and it's going to change in the near future.
Good.
But yeah, it's good to see it across the whole continent. We're seeing in many different cities in North America, including LA, and this recent HLA movement is very, very incredible to see. What was it,
65%, just short of two-thirds.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a huge turnout for that. It's not what I would expect.
Yeah.
All right, moving on to the next story we have by Ethan. What do you got, Ethan?
All right, folks. So, as you know, I am apparently this show's resident transit expert.
We're going to keep saying it.
And guess what? We're going to be
talking
about
senior resident transit expert.
Senior. Oh, wow. So now I'm taking on the senior title here. But regardless, we're going to separate from the bikes just for a little bit to talk about some transit, specifically in the city of Portland. Now, for a lot of you folks who don't know a lot about Portland, they are home to actually a fairly decently large light rail system called the TriMet Max. And now the Max Light Rail, unfortunately, deals with one major issue that probably is worse than a lot of the others in the system, and that is it gets severely delayed going through downtown. And a lot of this has to do with the fact that a lot of the trackage is shared with, you know, cars on the street, cyclists, pedestrians, buses. So that's a lot of interference that trains have to deal with. And when they have to deal with that, they have to slow down a lot, purely just to deal with the ability to brake in case of an emergency, as well as close stop spacing. So there's a stop every couple of blocks when you're doing that. A lot of different stops, you know, more dwell time, longer time to take to get through downtown. And also on top of that, there's a bridge where the speeds are restricted to 15 miles an hour. It's called the Steel Bridge. It's a really cool, you know, spot in Portland. But when you're trying to cross through the city on your transit, you're going to be dealing with that as an issue if you're restricted to 15 miles an hour. Now, there has been some, you know, slight murmuring in the past about a solution to this, but it's starting to be brought up a lot more of an actual real solution to this issue, and that would be to bury a couple of the lines underneath the city into a subway. And actually, an article very recently came out from one of Portland's major news sources, and it covered an actual plan to build a downtown tunnel for the light rail, which would grade separate it completely, remove a few stops, but however, have those stops be larger so they have a larger coverage area, and overall just reduce delays that can be caused by, you know, traffic in the city, everything like that, because these lines actually run through the entire downtown from one end of the city to the other in the metro area. So if you get delayed by someone, say, parking on the tracks for 5 minutes and idling, you're going to have that delay stick around for, you know, the entire time, and it makes transit a lot less reliable. And so this proposed solution is actually a really, really exciting thing to see, that a city that's kind of stagnated a little bit on transit is actually kind of suggesting to, hey, why don't we, you know, improve our transit just a little bit? And there actually has been studies too by TriMet to actually do this. So it's, they still say it's a while out, but they're still saying that they're looking into it. And with more popular support, I'm really hoping for the city of Portland and for its residents that it, you know, goes through. But do you guys have any thoughts on this?
Yeah. So is this proposed by the actual, is it the TriMet?
Yeah. So TriMet has actually done a study into tunneling the actual MAX light rail through the city. But the resurgent talk has really come from some news articles that have sprung up as of recent. So, I mean, like, it's not like they're really rushing it, but it seems like what they want to do is have it by 2040 from what I've seen in their study.
Yeah, this is like a no-brainer, I feel like. Obviously, it's expensive, but you have to invest in the future. And I think Portland can actually do that. By the way, that steel bridge, I went over that bridge. It's awesome. It's so cool.
It is just awesome.
The way it looks, like, it just got that really old school feel. And the fact that it raises up and down is just actually really cool. But
I biked over it, taken the train over it, and TriMet over it. And man, it's the fastest way to get over it is by cycling. Like, yeah. Right now, like, it's actually faster to cycle through downtown Portland than it is to take the MAX. So it's kind of a no-brainer to actually build this tunnel, because if your transit is slower than cycling.
But maybe that's why cycling got so big, was just because right. The transit was so slow.
Right.
Well, there are a lot of other reasons why cycling's big there, but, like, yeah, I mean, TriMet definitely isn't helping out with slow light rail in downtown.
Yeah.
I was going to say, everybody knows that the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago, and the second best time to plant a tree is, you know, now. And the same is true when it comes to tunneling for transit or just improving your transit. The best time to improve your transit was 20 years ago, and the second best time to improve your transit is today. So I'm glad that they're moving forward with that. I think it sounds good.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it kind of joins this little bit of a resurgence in actually building transit, especially on the West Coast. The East Coast cities have been kind of struggling a little bit. We'll get into that eventually later on down the line. But it seems like the West Coast cities have actually been, you know, building transit and saying, hey, you know what? Let's improve our systems because we need to cut traffic. We need to cut emissions. We need to, you know, grow our systems ourselves. And we can't rely on the car forever.
Right. Not everybody has access to a car.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And serving people who don't have access to a car, people who don't want to take, you know, public transit, or I mean, people who don't want to drive, you know, people who can't cycle, providing access via any mode of transit is going to be key for improving, you know, your city. But it really is important to see these kinds of changes. I hope that some community pressure in Portland actually kind of pushes this through a little bit faster. But we'll see. But I am really excited about this. This is a really exciting, you know, thing. And seeing actual positive news coverage on transit, even though the price will be expensive, because you can't dig a tunnel for cheap. It just doesn't happen, especially not underneath a river. But it is still very, very exciting and promising to see this.
Yeah, and I think it's something that any city could have. And this is definitely something I'd love to see in Portland, especially when you look at the map of Portland. It's a pretty suburbanized city. A lot of people live on the east side of the river, and a lot of people still drive into the city. Obviously, after COVID, things changed. I don't know if it's rebounded, but I remember a lot of reports saying, oh, cycling's down. It was misreporting. It's like, oh, no, all commuting's down.
Right.
But yeah, I think that's the thing when we talk about having more equitable transportation system is that it's not a place where the poor drive cars, right? It's where the rich people are using public transit. And when you make it really good.
I've never heard that. I love that. That's great. Say that again.
I think it's a developed country is not a place where the poor have cars. It's where the rich use public transportation.
Oh, that's great. I'm going to steal that.
It's not mine. I don't know who said it. I just remember hearing that.
I'm going to give you credit for it. Yeah.
It's going to be misquoted. Okay, I'll take it.
Right.
But yeah, like that's what you see in a lot of, like, obviously New York's like that in a lot of ways. Well, okay, there's a lot
totally, it is.
Being shuttled around in giant Chevy Tahoes and stuff with blacked out windows.
That's every city, though.
Yeah. But yeah, even in Vancouver, our SkyTrain network is pretty good. If you live near or along it and you work downtown, it's probably going to be the most efficient way, especially if you're going during rush hour. So yeah, this would be really cool to see in Portland. Awesome. Any more points on Portland's possible tunnel?
Well, I mean, it's going to be expensive. Every city's got to realize that. It's not cheap to tunnel anything. As I said it earlier, especially underneath the river, you do that and costs go right up.
Oh, yeah.
But hey, it's never going to be cheaper than it is now. So you might as well. And you're going to see a lot of economic benefit from doing it, too. Yeah. So,
well, if they do it and they do it well, I hope they can bring that over to Vancouver and we get one on the North Shore because we could really use it instead of using our ferry still. A lot of people could definitely benefit from a SkyTrain under the Burrard Inlet. All right, this next story we got is coming from UBC. So new evidence from UBC's React Lab, that's research on active transportation, suggests offering people incentives to purchase e-bikes can significantly reduce their reliance on cars. A number of e-bike incentive programs have launched in BC over recent years, including in the Victoria area city of Saanich, which offered buyers rebates of $350 to $1,600 through a pilot program in 2021 and 22. And the study found e-bike adoption subsequently surged in that community with 60% of purchasers being entirely new to cycling. That is massive.
Wow.
And those who took part also reduced their weekly vehicle traveled by 48 kilometers on average. That's a decrease of 30 to 40%. This is huge. So this is, like I said, React Labs, Alex Bagazzi over at UBC. I'm really interested in what he has going on there, and maybe we'll have him on the podcast.
Tell me what UBC is, Nick. Is that University of British Columbia?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
It's on the west part of Vancouver's kind of peninsula, west of the city. And it's the biggest Canadian university in the West Coast. This is great. So we had a pilot program just last year around this time. So about 12 months ago in Vancouver, there was a rebate that disappeared immediately, just like gone. Like people used it up the first day. They gave a small amount of money. I think it was less than $1 million and it disappeared. People bought e-bikes in Vancouver. And again, like we said here in this story, this is talking about Victoria area of Saanich, which is just north of Victoria. That's on Vancouver Island. So this is fantastic. And we're always talking about e-bikes on the program here. I love e-bikes. I don't have an e-bike. I use a regular bike still or my electric scooter, but one day I'll get one. It'll fit in the mix eventually. But yeah, this is absolutely massive to think that people, 60% of the purchasers were entirely new to cycling. And that's what I keep harping on. It's bringing in people who weren't interested in cycling or never thought they'd be interested in cycling before or getting on bikes and replacing their car miles. It's absolutely incredible. I love this.
It really is crazy how the e-bike is kind of just like the newest revolution of biking rather than being, you know, like, obviously you had your bike purists that would call it, you know, just like a fad, passing fad, you know, 10 years ago. But I mean, it's been huge. I mean, yeah, people who don't have, you know, the physical ability to ride super far on a, you know, conventional bike are using e-bikes to get further. People are using them to commute to office jobs and stuff like that. You don't have to break a sweat to ride an e-bike. It's still more active transportation than driving as well, too, just purely because you are actually physically moving, regardless of even if it is minimal movement.
Oh, it's not minimal movement. You know, you can pedal a lot on an e-bike. I think e-bikes are a game changer. I think it's the best thing that happened to the bike business in a long time. And I think it's going to supplement all of the scooters, you know, the Bird scooters and things like that, because you can't really go to the grocery store on a Bird scooter and come home with, you know, $30, $50, $100 worth of groceries. But on an e-bike, you can easily do that.
Yeah. A lot more cargo space availability, right?
Nick can tell you about bringing home groceries on an e-scooter.
Oh, yeah? Is there a story there?
Well, I warned people about hanging bags on their scooter because it can cause some problems there. It's definitely more advisable to get on the bike to do that. I walk to get groceries because, right, you know, I'm fortunate enough to live that close to my grocery store. But yeah, it can be a problem with an e-scooter. I think there's one e-scooter that has cargo. That's the Swifty G500 or something. It's pretty expensive. I think it's like $3,500. It has some cargo on it. But anyway, yeah, e-bikes are a game changer, and it's incredible to see them spreading. Now, when I was in Japan recently, I saw a lot of them, and I saw a lot of old ones, like Panasonic-branded e-bikes. And I'm like, that's got to be at least a decade old. Wow. But they're used very frequently there. I saw in Japan, mostly women, and having two child seats, one in the front and one in the back. That was mostly their cargo that I saw. But yeah, this is flattening hills. It's helping people get to work without a sweat if they choose to. Because, you know, like Taylor said, you can work on these things.
And oh, totally. Yeah.
Studies have shown that people who have e-bikes and use e-bikes, I think it was something like 95% of the exercise that they're getting. And that's because they ride further and they ride more often. So you're still getting that exercise, which is fantastic. And again, I can't say it enough. I have to repeat it. It's getting people who were never into cycling on a bike. Like, that is just such a win that if...
Well,
sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, Nick, it does two things. One, it increases the population of people who cycle because it allows disabled bodied people to ride a bike, but it also increases the distance with people can go on a bike. So, you know, you might, one might be normally comfortable riding 2, 3, 4, 5 miles to, you know, a coffee shop or a store or work or the gym or whatever. But all of a sudden with an e-bike, that distance is, you know, doubled. Or if not more. So it really helps on both of those fronts, getting more people involved in cycling and then allowing those who are cycling to go further in their bike trips rather than having to choose a car for that trip.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
And another point actually just mentioned in our chat here in the live chat, Austin said, reallocate the EV subsidies to e-bike subsidies and the benefits will be much further reaching. Yeah, and this is something that I've commented on a few times when I'm online, is that why don't we have a federal rebate for this? You think about all the millions and billions of dollars that are being sent out across North America, both in the United States and Canada, for electric vehicles, massive electric vehicles that have maybe one benefit over traditional gas vehicles, which is that they're not spewing out toxic fumes out the back end, right? Why aren't we doing this to e-bikes? It seems like it'd be a lot more beneficial to our budget across the entire continent, right? To think about all the money we're spending on highways, city roads, the amount of money we have to spend on healthcare for all the people, you know, suffering from lung lesions or different things like that. I know in LA, that's a huge problem with air quality.
Just sitting all day long in your car.
Yeah. Sedentary lifestyle. So, there's you could spend a fraction of that money on e-bikes for a rebate and the returns would be unbelievable. I don't remember. I remember seeing in New York City or something, in New York State, the amount of money was like $200 million or something was given to EVs in just a few months. To think about even a small percentage of that would be huge for e-bikes. Because we look at the sticker shock, right? We talk about sticker shock. Some people are surprised at how much an e-bike costs. I mean, when I look at it, it doesn't seem like a lot to me because I remember buying just a regular mountain bike like 8 years ago. 8 years ago, almost a decade ago, and it was like $1,100. Yeah. That's pretty expensive, but it's whatever. It was a good bike. You can get an e-bike for $1,500, right?
Wow.
You could go to Rad Power Bikes. They're very affordable. I'm not saying they're the best out there. Do you want a really good quality one for $5,000? There's the sticker shock, right? So helping reduce that price a bit, something that can last 5 to 10 years easily, right?
Is, and I mean, even if you're, you know, getting a less expensive e-bike too, just the fact that they've cut down this many miles or kilometers for driving is insane to think. That is huge. That's more emissions reduction purely from that little bit right there than any amount of EV tax credit for electric cars could ever do.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And you know where it's also a game changer is in the bike share business. Every city has a bike, not every, many cities have a bike share program, and the e-bikes are starting to take over those, that people would really rather use an e-bike when they use a bike share because they are going to work, because they are, you know, traveling a further distance to get to where they're going. And that's been really great also.
Yeah, it makes them much more useful. That's for sure. We've talked about them on the show many times. And of all the cities that I've used them in, New York, oh my God, their e-bikes are fantastic. They fly.
Yeah,
we need better ones here in Vancouver.
Bikes.
Yeah, I'm looking at Moby here in Vancouver. You guys need to shape it up, your e-bikes.
Got
to
bring up Portland again. Bike Town. Or not Bike Town. Is it?
Yeah, I think so.
Interesting. Yeah, that's a really good one, I will say, pricing-wise, too. It's more affordable than a lot of the other e-bike ones out there.
And they have almost exclusively e-bikes, so...
It is exclusively e-bikes. I love that, too. Which is crazy.
It's great.
And you know where it also comes in handy? When you have a couple, and one of the couple is a serious bike rider, and the other person in the couple is not.
Yeah.
It's a great device for the non-serious bike rider to be able to enjoy that activity with their partner. And I have a lot of friends who are doing that, either their husbands or their wives or their spouses, or they're just their partner, I guess, is not as into biking as they are. And now they do it together.
Yeah, actually, that's totally true. You just reminded me of a friend of mine and his partner. They're in Europe right now cycling, and one of them is on an e-bike, right? Because they couldn't keep up otherwise.
Yeah.
So it lets them enjoy that together. Yeah. We hail the e-bike here on Radio Free Urbanism.
Absolutely.
All right. I'm really happy about this. And I look forward to hearing more stuff from UBC's React Lab because they're doing great work over there. Maybe we'll have to get on Alex Bagazzi on a bonus episode to talk about what they're doing. But we want to ask Taylor some questions at this point in the show. So I'm going to go from this one at the top here. So there's a guy from LA who goes by Entitled Cycling, and he posts a lot of shorts cycling in LA, and a lot of it is close passes. He has like a speedometer on his bike somehow, so he can see the speed of cars coming and going, and basically just bad interactions with car drivers. Sometimes it's him passing cars, and
this is of course not the only one either.
Yeah, there's a lot of them. I'm sure he's got one of those 360 cameras on the top of his helmet, so he can like pan everything. It's fantastic. So yeah, just bad interactions with drivers. So it's whenever I see this stuff, it always gives me the impression that LA must be a hell to ride a bike in. So can you clear that up for me? Is it that bad? And what's your experiences cycling?
Well, first of all, the guy you're talking about is Tom Marash, and he's the Entitled Cyclist, and he's really wonderful. I've known him, 8 months or something like that, and he has been on Bike Talk. And he's really great. He always shows videos of bike lanes being blocked know, by police cars or, you know, whatever. But no, Los Angeles is not a horrible city to ride a bike in. It's fairly flat. The weather is fantastic, 11 months out of the year. And if you plan your trips, you're not always riding, huge distances. That said, the arterial roads of Los Angeles are bad and dangerous. And I seldom, if never, ride on some of those streets because they are dangerous. But one of the things I think is so great about cycling is that you can be a vehicular cyclist sometimes, meaning that you're riding your bike almost like you might drive a car, but you can also be a a pedestrian cyclist, which means if the road is no longer safe, you just get up on the sidewalk and ride on the sidewalk. And one of the good things about LA is there's no one on the sidewalk because nobody walks in LA. So you can ride your bike on the sidewalk. That said, when there is a person on the sidewalk, I'm usually very respectful of them and kind of give them deference. But I ride wherever makes me feel safe. And if that's in the road on certain streets, I go right on the road and get in the left turn lane and you know, ride my bike as I might drive a car. And if I don't feel safe on the road, I get on the sidewalk and ride on the sidewalk and don't worry about it. But no, Los Angeles is a good city to ride in, and it's getting better. We are slowly getting civic leaders, city council people involved, neighborhood council people involved that are understanding we can't keep this building going where we only support one mode of transportation, and that's the car. We're trying to get back to this idea of a 15-minute city. And Los Angeles used to be like that because Los Angeles was connected by rail cars for a long time.
Yep.
And there were little pockets of cities within where those rail cars went. And in the 60s, in the post-World War II era, when the cable cars and the rail cars and the light rail got out of fashion and was taken away, cars just allowed people to build in between all those little 15-minute cities, and it just became a network of roads for cars to drive on. So it was dangerous in the 90s and in the aughts, and it is still dangerous, but there is light at the end of the tunnel, and it is getting better.
That's fantastic. Yeah, it's something we've seen across North America, right? Back before the Second World War, it was completely different across the entire continent. We saw that. It was a traditional development, and we call it 15-minute cities. And that's been, you know, twisted in different ways, which we won't get into today.
Totally. Isn't that crazy that we have to spend time arguing about that to people who think it's government overreach or communism? Or it's like, you guys make up your mind. Is it authoritative? What's the word?
Authoritarianism.
I can't even say it now.
My quick piece of advice for everybody here and watching, don't waste your time with them.
Totally.
Yeah.
Well, don't waste your time.
I've been thinking about a lot.
You can't save everybody, but if you can save most people, then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, but definitely.
As far as the cycling infrastructure goes, Ethan has a question to follow that up. So go ahead.
Yeah. So, Taylor, real quick question for you. Is there any piece of cycling infrastructure that really kind of like left an impression on you, good or bad, especially around LA? Because there are definitely some really creative road engineers out there who have made some either really, really good pieces of infrastructure or just some really questionable ones. And I feel like LA would probably have a good mix of them. So is there really any piece that like thoroughly impressed you or like thoroughly impressed you in the wrong way?
Wow. Thoroughly impressed me, no. There's just not. The traffic engineers that are working with the city of Los Angeles and the backbone of the city council people that are supporting those traffic engineers are not bold enough, I don't think, to really put in a good roundabout or to really put in a protected bike lane. So I would almost... I mean, I'm sure there are some. Council member Nithya Raman has closed off a street in Griffith Park. Griffith Park is sort of Los Angeles' Stanley Park. It's not quite as big as Stanley Park or as beautiful as Stanley Park, but it's a great big urban park. And council person Nithya Raman did close off a cut through the park for cars, and it's just for bikes and hikers and stuff. So that's a pretty bold move, and I would say that's one of the better moves. Along Venice Boulevard, which is a pretty major east-west boulevard that goes from downtown Los Angeles all the way to the beach at Venice Beach, they have put in a protected bike lane by floating the parking lane and putting that in traffic. But as we were talking earlier, a bike lane is like a chain, and it's really only as strong as its weakest link. And so while you might have four or five blocks of this really nice protected bike lane, you soon come to an intersection that has no infrastructure upgrade and is very difficult to navigate. And a novice bike rider, I don't think, would feel comfortable crossing that intersection. And then the protected bike lane goes away for a few blocks, and then it goes back in. So, and Ethan, you were talking about this, about a network. We are still struggling to come up with a backbone or a network of bike routes that allow cyclists, people who ride bikes, who are not extremely confident on the bike and riding in traffic. There are a lot of sharrows and signs on the road that say this is a bike route, which is just completely crazy because it's not. I mean, there's a sign that says bike route, and that's all it is, and you can't even see it. So Los Angeles is still struggling, I think, with a lot of that, and they have not been bold enough in the past to really implement gold standard bike infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Do you think HLA is going to change that?
Boy, I hope so. It's a question of how much money is in the budget for doing that kind of stuff. Mm. That's always a go-to for civic leaders who don't want to go out on a limb and support some sort of traffic calming measure. It's not in the budget. We can't do it. But I do think HLA, which again is mandating that the city implement its own mobility plan when it updates streets, will be a step in the right direction.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah. So you talked a little bit about people having different abilities when it comes to cycling, their comfortability being on the streets. And can you tell us about what would you consider yourself? Which category do you fit in when it comes to confident, the interested but concerned, or the no way, no how? I know you're not part of that one, but yeah, which category do you fit in?
No, I'm a confident bike rider, and I bike almost anywhere. And again, as I said before, if I get into a situation where I'm not comfortable, I have no hesitation about getting off the road and riding on the sidewalk. A good buddy of mine and I, about 10 years ago, got tickets to the theater company, which is downtown Los Angeles, because we wanted a destination to ride our bikes at night. We are both actors, and so it was a fun thing for us to do. But we just made the decision, we're gonna buy these season tickets, and we're gonna every Tuesday when there's a show, it's like once a month when there's a new show, we ride downtown in our sport coats and, you know, kind of theater attire and see a play. And then on the way home, stop and get a beer or something like that. And that's because we wanted to have a destination. Having a destination when you go out for a bike ride is so much more fun than just riding to ride. While I love to ride to ride, it's also fun to ride to someplace and to show up there and go to the party or go to the show or, you know, whatever it is that you're doing.
Or just a third place that people like to visit. You know, me and my friend do that all the time, especially in the summers. We go to the beach. We ride our bikes to the beach and have a beer, you know, hang out and just people watch just look at the water go by.
Yeah. I get a fair amount of anxiety when I have to drive. I just don't like it. I don't like parking the car. I don't like driving the car. I'm happy when I ride my bike.
I agree. I'm the same way. Mm-hmm. If my wife offers to drive the car, I'm very happy. And this weekend we have to go somewhere up north, and she's like, "You have to drive. I got to work on stuff in the car." I'm just like, "Oh, come on!" But I ride. Exactly. I drive so seldom that I'm like, you know what? I could put up with it once a month. It's fine.
Sure. Yeah. And you know, to be honest with you, driving's great. I mean, on an open road.
Yeah.
You know, going 60, 70 miles an hour in a beautifully air-conditioned car, listening to the exact music that you want to listen to is a drug.
Yeah.
But so seldom is that the case. Usually, you know, you're stuck in traffic.
Driving is great. Having to drive is hell. Yeah. Right? Perfect. Those are the differences. And I know, I think I've brought it up on this podcast before, but when you say that, every time somebody says something like that, like driving's fun, I think about the time I was in outside Las Vegas driving down the highway. I was the only one. I was in a convertible car with the music blaring. It was amazing, right?
Yeah.
But having to drive to work, like even just having to drive to the store and thinking about doing that right now, I'm just like, oh, no. Like, no thanks.
Yeah. Take
the bike. I'm just thinking about the one time you're driving to Vegas. I'm like, you got lucky.
Maybe.
Totally, because the traffic is terrible in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Horrible.
I guess it was I'm outside the city, like towards Red Rocks.
Oh, no, that's the worst.
Is it really? Okay, well, I had a great time.
You got very lucky that day.
Yeah. Right.
Absolutely. I had one more question, but I think we talked about it with the HLA when we talked about the Firefighters Union. So we got some listener mail. So if you want to reach us, you can just comment on our YouTube channel or email us at radiofreeurbanism@gmail.com. And the first one we have is a comment from Sean Troy, 3172. And he said, I just got back from my first bike ride in the Netherlands, about 7 kilometers both ways between two little towns in the southwest of the country. I often hear critics of bike infrastructure saying that North America is too spread out for it to work, whereas Europe is very dense. But out here in Zeeland, the population is less than that of Tulsa, Oklahoma, and the population density is about 220 per square kilometer, half the country's average. Yet there is safe bike infrastructure everywhere. So the question is, what can we do to counter the narrative that bikes only work in big cities? And what insights do y'all have about small town urbanism? All right, Ethan, we've talked about this before, but you want to take it out?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, as someone who's lived in a small city, really, bike infrastructure goes a long way when it comes to a small town. But bike infrastructure, regardless, goes a long way into actually changing the modal share in smaller cities, especially like, you know, the ones that you're talking about in the Netherlands. If you provide that good infrastructure, people are going to use it. And if you build it out into a network, more people are going to use it to get to the places that they need to go, because it's cheaper than driving and it's more convenient than driving. And one city in the US that I think that has done this really well on a small scale has been Davis, California. Their modal share is somewhere, I believe it's around 14% for cycling, which is near unheard of in the US, especially for a city of its size. And it is just, it's phenomenal because they invested in cycling infrastructure ever since the 60s. They've been a city that's really been based around bike infrastructure. They've been doing this and especially supported by UC Davis, which is in the city of Davis, obviously. Small cities can have good bike infrastructure, and if you build it out in a small city, it's going to utilize it.
Yeah, absolutely. And we talked about this last week about small towns too, is you have that community, that sense of community. You have less traffic. A lot of the streets are naturally going to be slower, at least in smaller towns, in my experience. And where I grew up in a small town, not far from Detroit in Ontario, is that we would bike everywhere as kids. Most kids would just bike around, and the traffic was so light and slow that it was usually pretty fine. And again, I'm like a broken record, but like those are the best places to bike. Those are the at least the places that we should have in our cities. The vast majority of our places to bike are just local streets. They're safe. Right. They're slow. Mm-hmm. The traffic's really slow. There's not a lot of traffic, and that's what it should be made up of for the most part. But when you can't have that, that's when you want safe cycling infrastructure, like a grade separated bike lane, right?
Right. And there are always naysayers who are going to say, oh, we can't build bike infrastructure there. It's too rural. Or we can't build bike infrastructure there because it's too cold in the wintertime. And the truth is, people bike in Minneapolis in the wintertime.
Yeah.
And people bike in small towns all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, some people have to bike in small towns because they don't have a car, because they're maybe farm laborers or something like that. And we need to support them also.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Back where I grew up, it was a lot of tomato farms around there in Essex County. Tons of immigrants who come over, a lot of Mexican immigrants just to work for the summer.
Sure.
And you'd see them biking even on the country roads too. And
lived in a small.
What's that?
Yep. Lived in a small city, St. Augustine, Florida. A lot of service jobs.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't have cars. Parking's expensive downtown.
Yeah.
So you ride your bike to work, and then you ride it home.
Yeah. And right. As far as countering the narrative, I think it comes back to like what Taylor was just saying about, you know, people say, oh, you can't bike somewhere. It's too cold. It's too wet. It's too rainy. There's too much snow, et cetera, et cetera. You can always bring back to examples where that's not the case. And like the famous saying they have in the Netherlands, you're not made of sugar. You know, that's a big one. Oh, it rains too much, right? Put on a raincoat.
I haven't heard that one, yeah.
It's fine.
No such thing as bad weather.
Yeah,
right.
Just bad gear.
Yeah.
And that's it, right? So it's just keep collecting all the sayings and stuff that come around that, because you're going to see the same narratives come up over and over again. And these ones, like I said, that one's one of my favorites. We're not made of sugar, because it hits hard. It drives home a point and it says, hey, we're adults. We can deal with this. Kids can ride in the rain too. And what's that famous one? Is it in Finland? Is it Oulu? The town where they have amazing amount of modal share, something like 25%. And even in the winter, they have like 13% of modal share is cycling. It's because they take care of their infrastructure. They clear it, right? They even have projectors that project onto the bike lane that's snow-packed that shows that there's a bike lane symbol, right? So if you take care of your infrastructure, you get people to cycle. It's as simple as that.
Right. Well, they don't have to project it on the snowpack because they plow their bike
lanes. Right.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
First,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, we got another one here. Do you want to read this one, Ethan?
Yes. So this one comes from Commodore David L. And they said, hey, y'all, here in Maryland, we use another design that makes me trip every time. This photo was taken in College Park. Hard to ascertain the ramp angle, but look at the utility cover. I love Maryland. We try to be progressive, but we get it sort of right, sort of wrong. It takes us forever to update our construction standards to what's new and better, and I'm sure this situation has to do with all the impacts of stormwater management. Thanks for the great conversations about urbanism. I think that the image is somewhere.
Yeah, I'm gonna pop it up here on the screen in just a moment.
Got it.
So, yeah, this is thank you, David, for the email. And it's an interesting, is it a raised crossing? It kind of looks like a raised crossing. So here, it's on the YouTube channel if you want to see. So
It's like a sort of raised crossing kind of I'd say it's like a half-assed raised crossing.
Yeah, it doesn't look raised to me, you guys.
It just looks like a convex street.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's not even bulb outs. It's right. Got a curb cut.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, but
I mean, sight lines are good, but
that's the thing. I want to see more studies about sight lines. So sight lines being like when you come up to the street, you can see more of the pedestrians or cyclists coming across. Like, is it good to have sight lines or not? Like, if it's completely blind everywhere, is that going to make people more cautious? Like, that's what I talked about in my video when I was talking about Japanese streets, right? A lot of blind corners. And people naturally are going to be more cautious, at least in my opinion, if you can't see what's coming.
Right. You know, I've even heard that in Paris, in certain places, they have taken away stop signs. So there is no stop in either direction. So that as you enter that intersection, you know you have to go slow and look and make sure it's clear when you pass. Now, obviously, that's in a very calm area anyways. But it is it's just one more step to making sure that the driver's awake when they go through an intersection.
More ambiguity, right? Complexity. Yeah. Absolutely. All right, we got another one. This is from last week. We had to skip. This is from Reese B. Oh, sorry, by the way, David, the last email, I know it was way, way longer. You had something about transit in there, so I got to keep them brief. But this one's from Reese B. They say, we got an e-bike about 4 months ago and have put 330 miles on it since then. All during the wintertime here in Utah, we have it's Electric Expedition. I've ridden that one. It's massive. Which is a great bike, especially considering its price point. I look forward to the day when we can be a one-car family and justify spending a bit more on a nicer bike like an Urban Aero or something. Who knows? Maybe at that point the kids will be too big for it, but it's a dream of mine. Either way, I will be getting a bike that has a torque sensor instead of cadence sensor. I hear they are a whole new world. Plus, components like a belt drive and such are stuff I'm looking forward to having someday. For now, the bike I used for stuff like school drop-offs, the park, community garden, visiting friends, and church. Hopefully someday we can live in a place where the e-bike will be a legit car replacement where I can shop and do whatever I need to do by e-bike. Yeah, absolutely. Like this is what we just talked about earlier in the show about e-bikes and how amazing they are. And so Electric Expedition, is it a long tail, I think? Is a long tail
cargo bike? I believe
that's
their cargo bike, if I'm not mistaken. It's definitely a solid budget option. I'd say that for any of the electrics. But yeah, I mean, that's what the e-bike has done for even suburban communities. I mean, like even the most suburban, exurban, car-dependent communities have become a lot more bikeable due to the e-bike. That's just how revolutionary it is.
Yeah. You know, I have a question. What's a torque sensor instead of a cadence sensor? I don't know what that is.
So a torque sensor will actually measure how hard you're pushing on the pedal.
Oh.
And a cadence sensor just your revolutions,
your speed,
essentially.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
So you'll notice if you ever ride one and have them back to back, you can really notice it. So a lot of like the bike share ones use cadence sensors. So what you'll notice is you'll start pedaling and then all of a sudden that electricity will pop in and it'll just start pushing. A cadence sensor is much more, it's much more sensitive in that it understands how fast you want to go. Because I remember when I rented a bike when I was in San Francisco last time, it was definitely a cadence sensor. Because if I had it on the highest setting when I was trying to climb the hills, as soon as the electricity kicked in, it was like, boom, just like, it's like a turbo leg like you'd have on those old, you know, 911 Porsches or something, right? It would just kick in. But yeah, the cadence sensors are much nicer for sure.
Definitely.
Yeah, but Urban Aero, those things, cargo bikes, those are beautiful cargo bikes.
Those are real pieces of cycling engineering there.
And I know a lot of people use them, you know, when they have kids, a couple kids, you can fit in the front. But I'm sure I feel like if you had it and you didn't have kids that you had to lug around all the time, how much would a regular person get out of it? You know, the use out of that. It seems like it's overkill for so many things. Like you'd have to go for giant grocery trips like that. It's overkill for that, I find, too.
If you're doing rideshare delivery or something, like food delivery, I'm sure it's probably great.
Maybe,
If you're, for some reason, a contractor who uses an e-bike, probably seems like a good idea. But, like, yeah, I mean, unless you're hauling, like, appliances on the daily, I don't know.
Yeah. Because, I think about, like, all of the grocery trips that I make. It's not that much that I need to bring, like, four bags at most a couple times a week. You know,
a buddy of mine got married and I took he and his bride from the church to the reception in an e-bike, in a great big cargo e-bike that had a bay in the front with a big sign that said just married.
Oh,
and it was
amazing.
So much fun that the cars were honking at us the whole way from the church to the reception.
I love that so much.
Oh, I regret not doing that for my wedding. That would have been wonderful. Would have been on the nose.
And now we have our final question from the listener mail. This comes to us from friend of the show, Jen Hall. And she says, is there someone in your local cities like that like Kristen does a great job of featuring your city from a walking, cycling, transit perspective?
So
for Taylor here, Kristen runs the account Walking Detroit, which is both a blog, Instagram, TikTok of her experience walking and documenting the city of Detroit.
Being car free.
Wow. Exactly.
Wow.
So yeah, I read this and I put this in the show notes here and I was thinking about it. I'm like, in Vancouver, is there that person? And there's not. I don't feel like there is. There's a lot of people who talk about activism when it comes to walking, safety, cycling, but nobody car free. I think because it's so much more common. Like the thing that stands about Kristen and her work in Detroit that she has all these postings about walking is people are like, oh, how are you going to live in Detroit without a car? That's impossible. And that's what she's trying to spread is that it's not impossible. It's very doable. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's also Motor City. So
Absolutely. And like we talked about last week, the changing landscape in Detroit is wild. And you think that the GM building might be empty and turned into some, you know, urbanist hub or something where people will live is really poetic. But no, personally, I don't think I can. Nothing comes to mind for somebody in Vancouver like that.
You know, in LA, I can't think, you know, first of all, there are a lot of people like that. There's a lot of people who are car free in LA and either write about it or blog about it. But I can't think of any one person that is like the leader of the movement, in that area. Again, I think it's just because it's a bigger city and because there are more advocates involved that no one person sticks out. I think Tom Arash, the entitled cyclist, might be that for biking. We do have John Yee is the head of LA Walks. So he might fit that bill. But there's not sort of one citizen that I can think of that is carrying the mantle of moving forward by, you know, one foot in front of the other.
Yeah, sometimes there's like a bicycle mayor, and I think there's some organization in the Netherlands that kind of reaches out to people in different cities to appoint them to have this temporary position.
Oh, see, I want to be the bike man.
Yeah. We'll have to nominate you somehow and reach out to them.
Please do. This is the guy. We had John Bodders, who is the bike mayor from Emeryville, California, on Bike Talk this week, and he came on and talked. And I said, John, I want to be the bike mayor. And John said, you can be. So I don't know whether that makes me the bike mayor or not. But
just self-appointed. Yeah, I like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We had a comment here from Austin in the chat. He said about the e-bikes. He said, if people drive around alone in an empty mega SUV, you can drive around in a mega cargo bike with nothing in it. He's like, yeah.
Totally.
And also mentions that Patty Wines, is it Wayne's, would be the bike mayor of Winnipeg. I don't know who that is, but maybe I'll find out.
We've had Patty on Bike Talk before. She's okay. Great.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah. Hmm.
All right. We have no more questions in the show. Do we have anything else that we want to talk about, guys? Anything, Ethan?
Anything? No.
All right. Well, then that means at this point in the show, Taylor, plug away. Tell us, where do the people find you?
Everything.
What are you doing?
Well, great. It's really fun to be on the show. And I do think we need more of this cross-pollination, because I think that the word is starting to get out there and people are starting to, I mean, I listen to urban podcasts all the time. That's what I really enjoy listening to. I listen to The War on Cars. I listen to Strong Towns every now and then. I listen to Active Towns every now and then. I listen to you guys now. And I really enjoy making Bike Talk. And again, that's found at biketalk.org or at Spotify or Apple Music, wherever you get your podcasts. But, you know, we are also on the radio. We're in about 8 markets around the country. And that is both good and bad for us. One, it limits a little bit about what we can do on the show. We can't swear on the show. The show has to be 56 minutes long, things like that.
Okay, well, but you can swear here. Do you want to let out anything?
Fucking A. Sorry. But it also means that we reach an audience that isn't always looking for us, which I think is really nice. We get some people who just happen upon us and are into what we're talking about and then reach out and say, I found you Saturday morning on the radio, and now I'm a listener. And, you know, then they go to the online spot and listen to us. But I do think we are in a little bit of a sea change. I've been involved in this fight for a long time. And I don't know about you guys. Do you guys have kids?
Not yet.
No.
Yeah. Well, and I'm a little bit older than you all. And that's what really got me into it. Because like you, Nick, when I was a kid, I rode my bike everywhere. I got on my bike in the summertime and split and came home at dark. And I was, you know, visiting friends and going to the store and going to the gravel pits and going to the movies or, you know, whatever we did on our bikes. And we just had a blast. And my children, partly because I live in Los Angeles and not in Michigan, and partly because it's, you know, it was 20-aughts and not, you know, 1960s and 70s. Yeah. That it wasn't quite safe for my kids. So that's what really got me involved in, you know, working hard and fighting for safe streets for all bike riders, not just the confident, strong cyclist. And I completely forgot where I was going with this. But I was going to a really good point somewhere down the line.
We're planting the seeds whose tree shade will never sit in.
Yeah, and I do think that there's a sea change, and I think it's because of shows like Radio Free Urbanism, shows like Bike Talk, that allow us to matriculate what it is that we're thinking. And lately on our show, we've been talking a lot about disagreements within the movement, whether it be the vehicular cycling as opposed to having safe bike infrastructure everywhere, or whether it be when we do put in infrastructure, is a bike stripe enough, or is it only the gold standard? And there are all these kinds of arguments and fights within the movement, and I think that's okay. That's good. As long as it doesn't keep us from moving forward. I don't know if you guys know who John Forrester is.
Yes, the vehicular cycling master.
Yeah, we got beef.
Yeah, he was the guy. And what bothers me, what I know about him, I've never met John and I don't know him, but it was that he sort of at one point argued against building infrastructure because in his mind, it made us feel like cyclists and people who ride bikes were second-class citizens. Mm-hmm. And invariably, he threw the movement back 30, 40 years. Because if you look what the Netherlands did, everyone always says, well, Los Angeles isn't Amsterdam and Los Angeles isn't Copenhagen. But Copenhagen and Amsterdam were Los Angeles in the 1970s, but they made a change. And I feel like we're starting to make those changes.
Especially when you see different cities really embrace it, like we're seeing in the city of London and in Paris right now. And again, in many places in North America.
And I mean, if you've seen cities like, once again, bringing up Davis, California, they embraced it as well in the 70s too. And look at them.
And Santa Monica, California is doing it now. And there is pushback. We just had the mayor of Santa Monica on our show. And she talked about how, you know, it's one of those city councils where the mayor, you know, kind of changes within the council every year or two, and that the new mayor that was coming in was kind of an anti-biking person. And she was worried about if they were going to do sort of what's happening in Vancouver and make a step forward. And then when the new mayor came in, take a step back and take out some of the bike lanes or some of the bike infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And that's where I go back to this idea that, you know, changing the status quo is a learning curve, and it takes time, and we have to give these changes time for people to get comfortable riding their bike to the grocery store, to school, to the bar.
And until it's built into our traffic codes at the high level, you know, the federal, provincial, state level, you know, we're going to keep having that fight, that pendulum swinging back and forth. But we'll get there eventually. We're seeing, like we're saying, we're seeing the change.
And one of the best ways we can all spread the word is just by biking on our own.
Yes.
You know, just getting out there and riding to the store.
Be visible.
Especially in Vegas, Ethan. I mean,
absolutely.
Vegas is a great town, but it's a tough town to bike in.
Yeah.
It really is. I always say it's one of those rare towns where the further out you live from downtown, the better your cycling infrastructure gets.
Yeah. And this is a man who lives car free out there. Look at this
Vegas.
Guy.
Wow. Very good.
It's tough.
I can imagine. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Taylor, for being on the show. I really appreciate it. I love Bike Talk so much. Every episode that comes out, I eat it immediately. I'm like, that's what I'm listening to right now.
Thank you very much for joining us, Taylor. Thanks for having me, you guys.
It's been
wonderful. Great show.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us. I just have one little note. I want a book recommendation, which is Carmageddon, How Cars Make Life Worse and What to Do About It by Daniel Knowles. Most recent book I've read and very good book. It's on the whole urbanist scene, very consumable, very enjoyable, talks about the history of the car, how it came in, how it affected our cities, and how it didn't. How, for example, the streetcars in LA were taken out. It wasn't just the cars. There was a lot of things happening. People wanted them gone. They wanted their cars. It wasn't like the car industry just, they did everything. It was a popular movement. But then talks about the fixes that we can do now, which is great. And it's just a really enjoyable read. All right. We're going to end the show here. Ethan, take us out.
Ladies and gentlemen, you can find me over at Climate and Transit on most social medias, but you can also find me at Climate Transit on Twitter and also Train Good, Car Bad. Nick, where can we find you?
I'm at Nick Laporte on YouTube or Nick the Door in other socials. And Alex is at Humane Cities. And again, please check out Bike Talk. One of my favorite shows. So I'm just going to put that there at the end. Yeah. So two wheels good and feet first for Alex.
Two wheels good, four wheels bad.
The show is made possible by listeners like you. For access to early episodes, live shows, and other perks, join us on Patreon at Radio Free Urbanism.